off with several bangs, and I'm sure will carry on for the rest of the season. It's my very good fortune. My name is Ralph Yorsch, and it's my pleasure to chair this meeting. Some of you who are not members may not realize that this club is completely sustained by the membership fees. And most of the fees are spent in advertising, in the newspapers, in the brochures, in the mailings. So those of you who aren't members, we would certainly welcome you becoming members. I've had my interest excited about China when I was attending the University of Toronto, working on my degree in dentistry. And by sheer serendipity and my very good fortune, I found myself with a roommate who was sent from China to get his PhD degree in applied mathematics. I liked Chinese food, he liked Chinese food, so every night we would walk down to Elizabeth Street and have dinner, which gave us a half an hour down, a half an hour back, and a half an hour for dinner. I learned a little about China because he said to me, your job is to make my English as palatable as possible, and I hope I did my duty. So for 7 months, I did learn something about China. Now, how lucky I was that this very exciting man was my roommate, because he has gone on. He now, at the age of 92, is the president of Shanghai University. Obviously, they follow a different pattern than they do at UBC. He's done a variety of things. He's put in charge of simplifying the writing of the Chinese language. What a task. So when I was his guest over there in 1988, I says, how are you doing? He says, well, a stroke here, a stroke there. Things don't move very fast in China. Meanwhile, my curiosity was whetted there. I've been to China once. I found it very exciting. And I certainly recommend that you take a trip there and see things for yourself. But thinking about this, those of us who grew up in Canada grew up knowing just about nothing about the Orient. We have some inkling of British history, French, Greek, Mediterranean generally, some American, but as far as my education was concerned, China wasn't mentioned at all. Well, how lucky we are tonight to have some information from an expert who has devoted his entire life to the study of China. He is currently the director of the School for Higher Studies in Social Sciences. Professor Will, as you may remember from your brochure, if not, I will bring it back to your memory. Professor Wills holds a chair in Chinese history at the prestigious College of France in Paris. A specialist in 18th century China, he has published extensively in French and English on a wide range of topics, including famine relief, forensic medicine, and Chinese political institutions. His books include Bureaucracy and Famine in 18th Century China and Nourish the People. His current work focuses on the place of democracy and human rights in contemporary China. Would you help me welcome Professor Pierre-Étienne Will.
My speech today won't be to propose answers to the number one question: has China any prospect of becoming a democratic country, respectful of human rights, in the sense we normally understand these terms, any soon? Nor am I going to offer an answer to the related question, which is, if and when a transformation of China into a democracy happens, is this going to be a Chinese democracy, a culture-specific democracy, I won't offer answers to these questions because, in fact, nobody knows. And because being an historian and not, say, a political scientist, and even less an ideologue, making predictions or expressing wishes is not my job. In fact, I know as an historian that predictions about these sort of problems, either by historians or by whomever else, have almost always turned out to be wrong. My topic is a question related to the ones just mentioned, and it is more attuned to an historian's preoccupations and hopefully competence. This question, which of course I am not the first to have raised, as we shall see, is the following. Is Chinese tradition, not just political tradition, I should make clear, and assuming that such a thing as Chinese tradition singular exists, is Chinese tradition an obstacle to democratization? Or put differently, is there or not a kind of basic incompatibility between the two? Or, on the contrary, does China's past contain elements that might be favorably influenced, that could be favorably influence a transition to some authentic sort of democracy? Here again, I won't try to provide you with a ready-made answer because there is none, but I think that the question is important to raise and that there are many interesting things to say when we attempt to discuss it. I was just saying that whether China is or is not going to become a democratic country is the number one question. In fact, this is not quite true. Or I should rather say it is not as true as it used to be. One thing that I have discovered since I started a few years ago to do some research about contemporary problems, I am an historian of Imperial China by occupation, one thing that I discovered is that when you work on such contemporary problems and claim to apply to them an historian's meticulousness, which implies taking one's time, you find that you are being constantly overtaken by events and outmoded. The sort of questions I'm just raised are an example. 10 or 5 years ago, the future of democracy in China was very much a topical question. After the recent demise of the Soviet Empire, it seemed that the few socialist regimes still in existence were doomed to disappear sooner or later, which is to say, to hand over to democratic regimes, understood as Western style, liberal democracies based on the rule of law and human rights. The political transformation of China, which was of course the largest of these surviving socialist regimes, was a topic for discussion everywhere, including in China. In the years immediately following the Tiananmen backlash in particular, the political leaders of the West missed no opportunity to suggest to the Chinese leadership that political reform was a precondition for China's integration into the international order, and to remind them of the violations of human rights committed by their governments, especially against political dissidents. It was quite clear, to be sure, that the Communist Party leadership had no intention whatsoever to democratize the country any soon. And when I say democratize, I do not mean deciding on piecemeal local elections to improve the quality of local leadership, which has actually been done. What I mean is endowing the nation with a truly democratic constitution. In other words, a constitution that would not guarantee the monopoly of the Communist Party in the exercise of power anymore, and that would make it a possibility that it lose power as a consequence of free elections. But still, the West was putting pressure, as it were, and however mild the pressure, and the Chinese leaders at least had to show some concern. As an illustration, I would like to mention the interview of Jiang Zemin, the then first secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, by Mike Wallace of the CBS show 60 Minutes in September 2000, which I found rather striking at the time. I found it striking because Jiang Zemin was, so to speak, enjoined by the interviewer to provide an explanation of why he was so reluctant
to democratize China a little faster. And because he looked clearly on the defensive when providing his arguments. Besides, during that part of the dialogue, the screen was showing tanks roving Tiananmen Square in the background. To be sure, not everybody has had the same impression as me, and some argued that, on the contrary, Tiong had easily dominated Wallace, however aggressive the latter pretended to be in his questioning. But whatever the case may have been, the point I want to make is that today, in late 2005, such self-righteousness, almost lecturing during an interview of the Chinese head of state and party first secretary, would be, it seems to be, unthinkable. Even more than 5 years ago, China is not only respected internationally today, but also feared economically and more militarily. Everybody is aware of the global implications of its decisions in matters of diplomacy, strategy, monetary policy, or whatever. And these decisions are anxiously observed and analyzed by the Western governments. Thanks to massive investment, China is fast becoming a major power in science and technology, and it has even received the symbolic prize of becoming an Olympic nation. Not only is China no longer isolated internationally, but it has become a leading partner in every field. In this respect, the two major events might well be, first, its co-optation, so to speak, into the camp of the enemies of international terrorism after the 9/11 events, and second, its admission into the World Trade Organization, which was signed in 2001, exactly 3 months after 9/11, to which we should add its joining several international treaties and conventions, including on human rights, in the recent years. As a consequence of this considerable international influence and new respectability, the Chinese communist regime appears more firmly established than ever. And the fact is that it is difficult to imagine why it should masochistically program the end of its own political monopoly by embarking on a liberal democratic constitutional reform when more and more people in China are benefiting from the results of economic growth and taking pride in their country's new international stature. And the consequence, from our point of view, is that discussing how and when China should democratize is much less of a hot topic than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. Or say before 9/11. So, as I said, it might well seem that the topic is outmoded. Is it really, from the point of view of actual politics, nobody can say. There are much too many variables at work, both international and internal, to decide that the problem of a Chinese democratic transition has been decided once and for all, even though, from the point of view of the current leadership, it has. Only a few days ago, I think last Wednesday, only a few days ago, they released on the internet a lengthy white paper entitled Building of Political Democracy in China, which affirms that the system of socialist democracy with Chinese characteristics, that's the brand name, that is currently practiced is just fine, only needing to be, I quote, constantly improved and developed, of course, and that any suggestion that something else might be preferable is a manifestation of cultural arrogance. Whatever the case, from the point of view of historical analysis, I believe that despite the conditions just outlined, which are very different, again, from what they were when I started to research the problem of democracy and tradition in China, this problem, which, after all, has come under discussion time and again for well over a century, this problem remains as important and interesting as ever, and I can only hope that I will be able to convince you that indeed it is so. But, first of all, it may not be superfluous to recall that when we speak of democracy and democratization, we may not be always talking about the same thing. The implied model in most discussions is the Anglo-Saxon model of democracy with free markets as a corollary, and with ideally a small state and a large share of initiative left to civil society. This is, of course, what the United States currently claims it wants to export worldwide for the greater happiness of humankind, albeit with mixed results. But even limiting one's scope to the countries of the industrialized West, which are supposed to belong to the same general model or tradition, in fact, there are, in fact, many variations, whether one considers the election system, the systems, the distribution of power between elected politicians and appointed state officials, the role of money in politics, or this elusive concept called political culture, or whatever else. And of course, the variations are even bigger when one takes into account the whole range of regimes claiming to be democracies, including the so-called illiberal democracies that have mushroomed after the fall of the Berlin Wall, where we find a complicated and variable mix of indisputably democratic institutions, beginning with regular votes and the possibility, theoretical or even actual, of defeating the government, and habits, practices, and an approach to basic rights that take us rather far from the liberal model and indeed closer to the authoritarian regimes to which these illiberal democracies have frequently succeeded. Likewise, when one considers the degree of control exerted on markets, or the mix of political and socio-economic rights guaranteed by constitutions, or the judicial system and culture, the range of situations is considerable. Still, for the purpose of our discussion, it seems to me, even though I am no political scientist, as I hope is clear, it seems to me that a minimum list of conditions can be proposed, perhaps discussed, as defining an authentic democracy, a list that would include free elections and universal suffrage, of course, political pluralism, regular and frequent parliamentary elections, cabinets accountable to parliament, division of powers seen as a precondition for the rule of law, that is to say, for constitutional control of the actions and decisions of the state and government, judicial guarantee, and the protection of the basic rights and liberties. So that's a tentative definition, but of course, you can disagree. Now, to return to our problem, one might as well start from the arguments given by Jiang Zemin on the 60 Minutes interview I mentioned, and of course by the Chinese leadership on many other occasions, then and now. There are basically two of them. First, economic backwardness, and second, the specificities of Chinese society, historical traditions, values, way of life, and so forth. Something like what we could call in French, exception culturelle. The combination of the two arguments, it may be noted, is found in the Bangkok Declaration of 1992, a rather aggressive document which was jointly signed by China, Singapore, and Malaysia, and which claimed, first, that poverty is an obstacle to instituting a liberal democratic system, and then insisted on the specific nature of their societies and that their customs and ways of operating were not compatible with those of the West. The patronizing discourse of the West is clearly resented, and as is well known, the Bangkok Declaration made much to popularize the notion of Asian values. Economic backwardness or an insufficient level of development can be discussed rather quickly. The connection that is made between economic and political development makes democratic reform dependent on sufficient prosperity and a prosperity sufficiently spread out across society and with a sufficient level of literacy and instruction among the populace, as important corollaries. What should be considered sufficient is never made clear, to be sure. But in any case, this is the so-called developmental theory, which has had some advocates in the political sciences in the West, and which has been espoused by the Chinese leadership since the 1980s. In this theory, as I see it, absolute priority should be given to economic growth based on the development of the free market. And since for such development to be pursued without a hitch, or as they would say now, to be pursued harmoniously, political stability is an absolute precondition, if only to keep under control the social tensions created by the transition from a state-controlled economy to a free market economy. The consequence is that conversion to pluralist parliamentary democracy and to a legal system protecting civil and political rights would be a premature step, because it would inevitably compromise stability. This is why a leadership composed not of elected officials, but of experts chosen for the dedication, selflessness, and patriotism, typically engineers who are able to get to the bottom of problems and have a long-term vision to solve them, unlike politicians tied by the election timetable. This is why such a leadership is deemed the most desirable. And incidentally and interestingly, I have recently read American conservative columnists despairing of the political obsessions and short attention span of their own leaders and saying exactly the same thing. Anyway, as I just said, in the official discourse of China today, a high dose of political liberalization would compromise political stability. Worse than that, it would create chaos. This, at least, is what Jiang Zemin again told the New York Times editors in an interview in September 2001, a few days before 9/11, actually. I quote, Jiang Zemin, "I lived for three-fourths of the last century," he said, when asked about the prospects of a major political loosening. "And I can tell you with certainty, should China apply the parliamentary democracy of the Western world, the only result would be that 1.2 billion Chinese people will not have enough to eat. The result will be great chaos, and should that happen, it will not be conducive to world peace and stability." Would indeed creating free elections and a multi-party system bring 1.2 billion Chinese on the brink of famine? I tend to doubt it. But one can be sure that this sort of argument strikes a note in a country whose government has managed to ensure two-digit growth or close to it for years and promised to continue if it is left alone. In a country where more and more people are enjoying the results of this growth in terms of life standards and in a way of freedoms, like freedom to do business, to consume, to travel, and so forth, what some writers about China in the 19th century, which I will discuss in a lecture Monday, called practical freedoms. And finally, in a country where many people still remember vividly the chaos and hunger, not of democracy, but of Maoism. However, if the famine argument is demagogic rather than anything else, the threat of fear of political instability may seem more serious. According to the same line of argument, a Western-style democracy can only work in a prosperous and therefore highly educated environment. In an economically undeveloped country, by contrast, the educational level is too low to implement satisfactorily such an apparently complex task as knowingly choosing one's deputies. As Jiang Zemin said in his TV interview with CBS, I quote, "the quality of our people is too low." And this reminds us of all the official talk these days about creating an advanced culture for the Chinese, except, of course, that this advanced culture is supposed to be a socialist advanced culture and not a necessary condition for and prelude to radical political reform, of course. And of course, not a few people have pinpointed the contradiction between this notion of a China not worthy of acceding to the more modern forms of political organization because it is too poor and undereducated, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the successes that the government is justly boasting about in the domains of education, public health, scientific research, and most prominently, economic growth. The argument seems especially difficult to accept these days when one sees the prosperity and incredible vitality of the Chinese cities, and not just a few big cities, and when one experiences the feeling, however implied, of many people in China, that China is in the process of becoming a superpower. Indeed, a superpower that has no patience for being lectured by the West and no need to imitate foreign models. So that it is quite possible, in fact, that the argument of backwardness does no more than reflect the nervousness of the current leadership about what the poorer half of China, or perhaps more than one half, would do, how it would vote if it were allowed to do so freely. I'm speaking, of course, of the rural masses, especially in the inland provinces, which are clearly the neglected part of the population as far as enjoying the benefits of this much vaunted economic growth is concerned, and among which there is much resentment and frustration, even though for the moment this resentment and frustration are expressed, perhaps with occasional violence, but only in a limited and dispersed fashion. Certainly, they might not be mature or culturally advanced enough for casting the correct votes in an election that would have implications for the survival of the current leadership. Some Chinese opponents from outside have pointed out, maliciously enough, that at the time of the first United Front in the 1940s, when the Communist Party passed itself as a champion of democracy against the dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek, the communist press celebrated illiterate peasants electing their representatives by throwing colored beans in the ballot box, and claimed that underdevelopment and illiteracy were not the problem, just a pretext for the government not to organize free elections. In any case, and however one may feel about such issues, I will simply conclude these considerations on developmental factors by recalling that, in the end, the so-called economic theory, according to which there is a historical correlation between economic and education indicators on the one hand and the emergence of democratic regimes on the other hand, that this theory has foundered in the face of overwhelming counter-evidence, especially in Asia. It should be enough in this respect to remember the contrast between rich but authoritarian Singapore on the one hand and the much poorer but indisputably democratic India on the other. If the difference of trajectory is to be explained, then it is necessary to look for other factors. It is there that we may now turn to the other part of the argument, the one that one might call the cultural relativist argument, or perhaps in this case the Asian values argument. In other words, the claim that the traditions, social customs, and spiritual values of China are averse to the sort of competitive, adversarial, and individualistic democracy that the West tries to impose on her. But this remains rather vague, and what I would like to do is evoke some discussions, mostly dating back to the last century, about the role, either positive or negative, that is attributed to Chinese culture, notably but not exclusively what is called Confucianism, as far as the possibility of a transition to modern democracy is concerned. As is well known, alongside the rather crassly political and openly authoritarian sort of cultural relativism that was proclaimed by the signatories of the Bangkok Declaration, there exist more philosophical variations of the same theme, which have been developed by intellectuals rather than politicians, even though the latter are generally rather good at taking over the former. And in those more philosophical versions, Asian values are most often subsumed under the notion of Confucianism. Confucianism being considered to be the dominant tradition in China, or even the very essence of its culture. I won't elaborate here on the fact that in such discussions, what is called Confucianism is a somewhat shapeless set of common ideas which have not much to do with the many varieties of actual historical Confucianism, all the way from the sayings of the master who lived in the 5th century BC to the late Qing elaborations, or should we say elucubrations, by such utopian reformers as Kong Youwei. It will be enough to recall summarily that in this view, the so-called Confucian values, such as priority to the family over the individual, group orientations and a taste for consensus, valuing hard work and saving, reciprocity, the respect of hierarchies, and so on and so on, that in this view, Confucian values explain for a good part the recent, sometimes not so recent in fact, economic successes of the countries belonging to the periphery of the Sinicized world, such as, of course, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, or Hong Kong, not to speak of the communities of the Chinese diaspora in Southeast Asia and elsewhere. And the same values might also have played a role in the recent and spectacular economic takeoff of China itself, since she has set out to liquidate her revolutionary heritage. In other words, Confucianism cannot be blamed for economic backwardness or for being a hindrance to modern-style capitalistic development. For some authors, on the contrary, Confucianism is a favorable factor for this sort of development, exactly in the same way as Max Weber theorized that Calvinist Protestantism was the explanation of modern capitalism. But this is only one part of the argument. The other part is that the ethical and social values embedded in Confucianism, as well as the Confucian version of human rights that, according to some, can be found in the classics and in the works of historical Confucian philosophers, could become the basis for a new style of communitarian and participatory democracy, and for an approach to human rights that would be distinct from the individualistic and competitive style of the West. And of course, that would be the correct and natural way for China to escape authoritarianism and become democratic without renouncing its tradition. And this would be a sui generis kind of democracy, not one imposed by the West, which in any case, for many proponents of this theory, is in the throes of deep moral crisis and is itself looking for new models. Again, this brand of Confucian democracy, if we can call it that way, in which there is no conflict whatsoever between tradition and democracy, is an invention of philosophers, the so-called New Confucians. And what is more, its main proponents today have been English-speaking scholars, quite often Chinese English-speaking scholars based in American universities or in such places as Singapore. It is clearly a utopian view, but the interesting thing is that it has been embraced for their own very real politic purposes by the authoritarian leaders of China and Singapore, for whom it seems that to be a convenient, for whom it seems to be a convenient source of scholarly or pseudo-scholarly arguments against what they consider to be an unacceptable intrusion of Western-style ideas. And the Confucius, who for some years has been again celebrated on the mainland of China with state support, sometimes quite lavish, is certainly not a democratic Confucius. More interesting to examine, and I think much more important historically, are the negative interpretations of Confucianism, of the cultural tradition in which it is supposed to be the foundation, and of its impact on the Chinese polity and society, and even mentality. Indeed, and importantly, in this line of thinking, of which the most powerful manifestation was the New Culture Movement that culminated with the May 4th movement in 1919, and in the years after, in this line of thinking, the deleterious effects attributed to Confucianism are seen to be inseparable from the autocratic institutions of China during the more than 2,000 years of the imperial regime, and in fact, until the present day. The reason, of course, is that Confucianism as an ideology was favored and supported by the imperial state, that their fates were, so to speak, bound to each other. And this, incidentally, is in stark contrast with the positive and even rosy view of Confucianism that I mentioned before, whose proponents attempt to dissociate the eternal truths of Confucianism from the vicissitudes of Chinese history, or even to assign to them, to these eternal truths, a universal purpose. In any event, it is in this perspective of a fatal association between Confucianism and the political institutions of China that one should understand the most damning and occasionally the most disparate considerations on the character, even on the nature of the Chinese, and on their inability to free themselves from their long history of subjection to authoritarianism and take control of their own fate by entrusting it to a state based on democracy and human rights. I could mention an infinity of such indictments of the ethical and intellectual system that is taken to be at the core of Chinese civilization. And I should add that these indictments can be found in diverse forms, both in considerations by foreign observers or scholars, and above all, in considerations by the Chinese themselves. And it sometimes happens that the last appear close to mesotism. It is rather rare, let me note to begin, but occasionally found in 19th century European authors that the defects of the Chinese, which are supposed to prevent them from converting to modern civilization, that is based on some mix of Christianity, capitalism, and democracy, it is rather rare that these defects are ascribed to race. Mostly the interpretation is cultural, and the shortcomings which are deplored or denounced are more or less the same with either Western or Chinese authors. What they speak of is a mentality built by family and state institutions, several millennia old, of course, a mentality characterized by the respect of hierarchies and the general submission to all forms of authority, by an obsessive taste for harmony in social relations, and consequently by a propensity to avoid or at least to camouflage conflict. And it is a fact that such mental and behavioral traits would hardly be conducive to a healthy practice of democracy, at least in the liberal and competitive or even contentious form that is practiced in our countries. As far as foreign observers are concerned, I won't dwell on what we find in many 19th century authors. I am actually giving a lecture on that this Monday. But I would like to mention briefly a certain academic school of political science, mainly American, which was especially active in the 1970s and 80s, and attempted to bring to light the historical and cultural origins of present-day Chinese political culture, between quotes, as it's called. For these scholars, the best known among whom is probably Lucian Pai, I don't know how you pronounce his name, the principal explanation seems to lie in the processes of education and socialization traditional in China, whose main loci are families and, to a lesser extent, schools, transmitting the values supported by the state. And the consequences, as they see them, are, as I said, respect for authority, the priority of collective, especially family interests, the correlative undervaluing of individual expression and independence, the overvaluing of unity, and the avoidance of conflict supposed to characterize so the Chinese in general. In short, conformism and docility are engraved in Chinese minds from an early age, and for this reason, it is not surprising, of course, that authoritarian regimes have always been able to live on in China, both in the past and today. I mention this line of explanation, which is based on what we might dub a kind of educational determinism, not because it is intrinsically interesting, but because it seems to me typical of an approach to Chinese culture that is widely popular with the general public for a simple reason, which is that it is so easy. This approach is based, if I can use such words, on an essentialization and a dehistoricization of Chinese culture that reduces it to a few institutions, a few philosophical notions, and a few customs, whose origins are ascribed to an abstract and timeless past. It claims to find the roots of the present in Chinese history, but in actual fact, it rests on a profound and sometimes laughable ignorance of history. This is particularly annoying with academic works, of course. Just to give you a few examples of why such generalizations do not hold water, at least from an historian's point of view, it seems to me impossible, for one thing, to reduce the so-called political culture of China to one tradition, autocratic, Confucian, and the like. What is essential if one wishes to study contemporary politics in the light of tradition or of the past is first to take into account the vast repertoire of institutions, practices, and ideas found in history, and second, to examine how this repertoire has been constantly redefined through the debates, the conflicts, and the transformations that make up the dynamics of history. What is, for example, autocracy? During the last century of the Ming Dynasty, roughly from the middle of the 16th century to the middle of the 17th, the emperor was under constant fire from the officialdom and political society. Factionalism was rife, and political life was contentious enough to impose several times to the emperor a radical change of personnel and of politics. In contrast, for most of the 18th century, the Manchu emperors of the Qing dynasty were successful in repressing factions, in making any criticism of their personal behavior and of their way of governing into a crime, and in having total control of the appointment of personnel in the higher ranks of the bureaucracy. So two totally different sorts of autocracy, so-called. And these are just examples. So that we may well ask, where is the true tradition in all of this? Then, to take on a more societal kind of question, what are we to make of the reported obsession of the Chinese with harmony and their claimed detestation of conflict? If we read the official handbooks and judicial sources, for example, the enormous quantity of published judgments and arbitrations by local magistrates that we find in 18th and 19th century anthologies, if we read all of these things, we get an impression that the Chinese, both in towns and in the country, were constantly fighting each other on any kind of pretext. And that's exactly what the magistrates themselves say in countless handbooks where they talk about their personal experience, complaining that people are going to court even for the most futile reasons, that there is no much generosity or spirit of yielding zhang, to cardinal qualities, Confucian qualities in Chinese, among the populace, but much cunning and much calculation, and so forth. And I am not speaking of the flourishing corporation of pettifoggers, hated by the magistrates, but apparently much used by the citizens for their services. Strikingly enough, in these sources, the family is more often than not the locus of conflict, with such causes as problems of inheritance and sharing property, the competition between brothers, the fighting between wives supported by the native families and mothers-in-law, and many more. After all, Kang Youwei wrote somewhere in his book of the Great Unity, the state enjoys moments of peace, the family never. So much for harmony and avoidance of conflict. Now, of more interest to us and to be taken more seriously is the negative discourse held on their own culture and behavior by a number of modern Chinese authors who are deploring the submission of their people to despotic rule and their inability to evolve a modern form of citizenship and government. Chinese authors who are, they too, reaching back to history and traditional culture to understand how it came to be so. This discourse, it seems to me, originated more or less at the end of the 19th century when discussing social Darwinism was a fashion among Chinese intellectuals, and for good reasons, since there was, this was a time when the Chinese nation might seem to be on the brink of being dismembered and eaten up by the more robust and aggressive nations of the West and by Japan. Then the problem of the cultural or even civilizational causes of the weakness and backwardness of China and the Chinese was indisputably becoming urgent. I was speaking of masochism about this new discourse, and the fact is that the statement of Jiang Zemin that I mentioned earlier to the effect that the quality of our people is too low, that these statements may seem fairly benign when it is compared with those of some authors who, one might say, are not far from expressing kind of disgust of being Chinese. Now, these authors may be Chinese, but as a matter of fact, they are not no more historically sophisticated concerning their own country and culture than the social scientists I was mentioning and criticizing a moment ago. We find again the notion of a national character molded by 2,000 years of despotism and Confucian education, and these acquired characteristics transmitted from generation to generation are again and again denounced as the most fundamental obstacle, because it is so deeply internalized, the most fundamental obstacle to the emergence of a modern and democratic culture. The basic traits are, again, the submission to authority and to group interests, and from there derive such flaws as hypocrisy, dissimulation, selfishness, and a lack of civic virtues. And the formula that subsumes it all is a slave mentality. A history of this discourse would be too long to trace here, but still, let me give you a brief overview. Perhaps its origin is to be ascribed to the early Qing scholar and Ming loyalist Huang Zongxi, who wrote in 1662 a pamphlet proposing a drastic reform of the state system. The first essay of this pamphlet, in particular, was an incredibly scathing denunciation of the despotic institutions and rulership originating, according to this author, with the imperial unification achieved by Qin Shi Huangdi in 221 BC. Huang is not denouncing Confucianism. He is denouncing its confiscation by despots who distorted it and used it for their own private interests. And he is definitely deploring the condition of slaves into which the subjects of the empire were reduced. Huang's contemporary, the equally famous Wang Fuzhi, also made a similar sort of denunciation, but there was a difference, and the difference was that he was ascribing the defects of the Chinese, such as rapaciousness, selfishness, cowardice, submissiveness to force, and an absence of dedication to the common good, he was ascribing them to the despotism of the alien, barbarian regimes that had dominated China so often in Chinese history and were again dominating her in Wang's time. Wang Fuzhi and especially Huang Zongxi are worth mentioning here because they were resurrected at the end of the 19th century after a long period of oblivion and were widely read by those anti-Manchu nationalists and revolutionaries who were combating the despotism of the Qing and trying to raise the Chinese people to action. This generation of late Qing opponents, who were heavily influenced by Western ideas and by the successful rise of Japan, where many of them had gone to take refuge or to study, or both, were also prone to deplore the condition of slaves to which the Chinese had been reduced. Strikingly, in a text of 1901, the famous Liang Qichao, one of these refugees plotting against the Qing from Japan, the famous Liang Qichao asserted that the Chinese are four times slaves. They are slaves of the ancient, of customs, of circumstances, and of their own passions. And as a result, they do not possess, to use his words, the virtue of behaving like free men. Ziyou de. This certainly is an indictment, if there was one, of the culture as a cause for the impossibility of democracy. Only what Liang Qichao calls circumstances, by which he may mean either Western aggression or Manchu overlordship, or both, only this circumstance can be considered as an extraneous cause of the problem at hand, of this mentality of slave. But, as everybody knows, by far the most radical attacks by Chinese intellectuals against their own native culture came less than two decades later with the iconoclastic New Culture Movement, which started in 1915 and which culminated at the time of the so-called May 4th Movement that erupted in May of 1919, when the news was received from Versailles that the German possessions in Shandong province, instead of being returned to China, had been given over to Japan. The leaders of the New Culture Movement were at the same time highly educated in the traditional Chinese scholarly disciplines and extremely conversant with Western languages and ideas. Those were the people who proclaimed that if China were to be saved, she would have to hand herself over to Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy, that in my country we call Madame Science and Madame Democracy, and that this would imply a radical change in the culture and in what was called the national character of the Chinese. And it was then that Confucianism and its morals came under an all-out attack as the cause for an inhuman, some even said a man-eating society, whose submissive Confucian subjects were the opposite of the free and equal citizens of a modern democracy, like those of Western countries or even Japan. Again, because of their culture and of Confucianism, the Chinese were slaves, between quotes. And the same notion comes up again in the discourse of the intellectuals of the human rights movement, very interesting movement, who were opposing nationalist dictatorship in the 1930s and 40s. And it comes up again forcefully and much closer to us in the remarkable intellectual revival that took place in the 1980s and was called at the time the cultural fever. Taking advantage of the policy of reform and opening launched by Deng Xiaoping from 1978, Chinese intellectuals quickly initiated themselves into Western non-Marxist ideas and social sciences, at the same time as they were rediscovering the Chinese intellectual tradition. And again, they embarked on a thorough and merciless examination of their own culture and of the character of the Chinese people, the Guominxing, explicitly following in their May 4th movement predecessors' steps. What they were attempting to do, essentially, was bring to light the deepest structural problems of Chinese culture and understand why the Chinese still were in a state of submission to autocracy. The most spectacular and at the same time the most damning illustration of this quest was the 1988 television series Heshang, meaning more or less yellow, it was translated as Yellow River Elegy, in which Chinese civilization was described as a prisoner of its continental orientations, symbolized by the unchanging flow of its yellow river, shut behind its great wall and submitted to its despots. Her only future, according to the film implied, was to adopt the blue ocean-oriented, open and conquering culture of the democratic and scientific West. This was assuredly masochistic, and it highly displeased the authorities, who forbade the film quickly. But even more so was a book published in Taiwan and widely successful on the mainland in the mid-1980s, so in the middle of the cultural fever, a collection of essays and speeches by a writer named Bo Yang, whose title is self-explaining. This is the title of the English edition, The Ugly Chinaman. Bo Yang describes in an incredibly corrosive way what he considers to be the degeneracy of Chinese culture under the twin influences of Confucianism and despotism, a process that he too believes, like Huang Zongxi, believes to have begun at the time of the imperial unification of China in the 3rd century BC, and which largely explains, in his eyes, why the Slavish, again, Chinese, were unable to build a democratic society. Now, this self-deprecating and pessimistic mood, which it seems peaked just before the Tiananmen events, appears to be completely out of fashion now, 15 years later, when China is no more democratic than it used to be, but appears in many ways to be highly successful and is courted and respected by the whole world. This is also the time when, as I said at the beginning, the new Chinese leadership seems to have decided once and for all that mechanically copying the Western bourgeois political system and applying it to China would lead nowhere, this was a quotation, and that its own type of socialist democracy with Chinese characteristics, which the document celebrates with much wishful and tautological affirmation, is what China needs. And to be less than ever, and the same leadership seems to be less than ever prepared to accept any suggestion to the contrary. Does this mean that this combination of economic and international successes on the one hand and intellectual closure on the other renders any reflections on further developments and therefore on the role of tradition in them superfluous from now on? I am convinced that it does not, and for several reasons, and let me try to briefly enumerate them as a way of conclusion. The first reason, as I already said, is that nobody knows what the future has in store. The present Chinese leadership would obviously like to think that it has achieved its own end of history. But again, without wanting to make any predictions, I think we can safely say at least one thing, which is that there is no such thing as the end of history. The combination of authoritarian so-called democratic centralism and economic success cannot endure forever in the same form. Something else will have to be considered again. To give you just one example, the increasing participation of China in international legal networks, especially since its joining the World Trade Organization, and the development of the legal professions and specialties, including constitutional law in China now, recently, very recently, seem to be bringing interesting changes, not only in an increasing proportion of the citizens' approach to the rule of law, but also in their perception of the relation between legality and the exercise of power. There may or there may not be interesting future development in this line. I suspect that there should be, but their political effects are unpredictable as yet. Therefore, and this is another reason, it remains of the utmost importance to study and evaluate what I would call the repertoire of cultural and political resources in the Chinese past. Because history, if only the tumultuous history of the previous century, shows that whenever there is a crisis, or a phase which may be seen a kind of crisis, a phase of particular openness and searching, the Chinese are especially eager to look into this repertoire and make use of it, either positively or negatively. So, to return to the initial question, is this repertoire containing things that might be useful for a turn toward more pluralistic politics and an enhanced role from ordinary citizens in choosing who is going to rule them? Or is it, as we just saw, that so many people in China have been deploring, is it only a source of selfishness and despotism? I think that the point to make here is that no tradition can be accepted as a fatality that determines the future. What is important is how its components are reutilized and reinterpreted, or even, to use a famous phrase, how they are reinvented for the new purpose at hand. And if one accepts this flexibility in the use of any repertoire of resources, then it is easy to see that the Chinese repertoire is remarkably rich in elements that can be turned to democratic resources. Some of them have actually been celebrated for a long time by Chinese democratic militants, such as the egalitarian examination system and the insistence, at least in the discourse, on virtue and competence as criteria for public office. Also, the old notion of the people as master of the empire and of its philosophical right, their philosophical right to expel a regime that has not fulfilled its mandate, the so-called right to rebel, which has sometimes been a little hastily compared to democracy, to court. There is also a tradition of high-minded resistance to despotic abuses on the part of the Confucian educated class, and especially its representatives in the bureaucracy. Here, too, the more famous example of literary opposition in the late Ming Dynasty in the 16th, 17th centuries has been compared to a sort of democracy. But beyond these classical examples, if I can say, many other things might be mentioned, such as a long tradition of valorizing civic-mindedness among the elites, a number of public organizations, philanthropic or others, using such notions and often practices as the rotation of responsibilities, the election of the managers by ballot, mandates limited in time and with accountability, and so forth. Then we have a remarkably well-organized and predictable system of penal law, the de facto security of property, a well-established tradition of public protest and of petitioning the officials with expected results. And we have legal principles, if not always realities, far from it, concerning fiscal precision and fairness, official integrity, fairness, in the funding of public institutions and enterprise, and so on and so forth. I could continue the list for a long time. The point here is that despite the innumerable distortions they went through in historical practice, which have made not a few historians speak of mere hypocrisy about all these principles and ideas, and despite the frequent poorness or absence of legal definitions, the repertoire I have just sketched can easily be mobilized to contribute to a democratic experience, and it has been. The remarkable enthusiasm and vitality of the first Chinese democratic experience, with all the grassroots organizations that sustained it from 1912, and in fact several years before, at least locally, to the coup d'etat of President Yuan Shikai that shut it down in 1914, this episode, regrettably, is not at all well known. Instead, it has been said, and is still being said by the present leadership, that the foundering of this young republic at the hands of militarists is a proof, I read it just this afternoon in this white paper, is a proof that this sort of system was not made for China, that it had been the result of the careless importation of a foreign model not adapted to Chinese realities. The PRC leadership is less at ease, to be sure, as far as the experience of the Republic of China in Taiwan is concerned. Because this is pure democracy now, certainly not without its problems, but what democracy has not its problem, its problems, but working and not looking like it is threatened from the inside. And yet, this is also China, and with a lot of tradition going into the experience, including elements of local religious traditions that may seem rather unexpected in such a context. Besides, another sort of tradition also seems to be an important component of the Taiwan experience, and this is the local electoral practices that the Taiwan has learned during the half century of Japanese occupation, which was otherwise extremely harsh, but during which they were subjected to this sort of experiences, which they kept. And speaking of Japan, let's not forget that the possibility to import a modern political system devoid of any local roots, without endangering one's own identity and without creating turmoil, was demonstrated, more or less, by Meiji Japan at the end of the 19th century, and that this was observed with much interest and passion in China at the same time. The conclusion of all of this is that there is no one tradition, political or otherwise, that can be studied as a univocal factor in the past and future of political change in China. There is, as I tried to suggest, an extremely varied repertory that needs to be interpreted and made use of by its very owners, and has already been, of course. This tradition, if we want to call it that name, is neither, as some has contended, a tradition that could and should have led to democracy, and still can and perhaps will one day, nor is it, as many others have said, a factor of immobility and backwardness that could only fatally keep China out of the path to modern development until she switched to another form of culture. In short, I see it as an open-ended tradition, still very strong in many respects, but adaptable to all sorts of things. And we can only look forward to seeing all the interesting and unexpected combinations that the future may still hold in store. Thank you.
We have a tradition of a question period, and I'm sure that Dr. Will will
accept this tradition, yeah.
Yes. We'll do his best to answer. So if you will pose your question in two or three sentences or less, fire away. Yes.
Maybe you could say something about...
Would you stand up, please, and
yes.
Sing out?
Could you say something about the fact that if there is democratization in China, the government, the central government, will be very worried about the centrifugal forces of Xinjiang and Tibet, right in fact, to go away from China. And that's a problem that Taiwan, of course, doesn't have to deal with.
Yeah, you mean that it will be one factor of destabilization, as I said, which, of course, the consequences upon the dominions of, outer China would be certainly very much feared, yeah. Although, this is true, but I should say one thing, is that quite strikingly, the Kuomintang regime, the nationalist regime in the 1930s, which was much less solid than the present-day communist government, managed to, and which was under threat of, England, Russia, whatever, managed to maintain these dominions intact and transmit them over from the Qing to the People's Republic. So even a government, it was not a democratic government, of course, but it was a weak government in many ways. So there is not a direct correlation. But still, you're right. It's certainly part of the problem.
Yes.
I just wanted to point out that one of the many potential resources for developing toward democracy in China is a long tradition of de facto local self-governance in Chinese villages, mm-hmm. rural villages, rural communities, which were...
What is your question, sir?
No, it's coming.
Yes. Get to it, please.
Well, I really don't have a question. I just have
well, we'll only take questions.
All right.
So the question might have been, why didn't you didn't you mention this? Because it's absolutely. And in fact, I will talk about this Monday, because this so-called local village self-administration was something very striking for all the foreigners who visited China in the 19th century. But you're right. I should have included it in my list.
Yes.
Thank you for interpreting my question.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a difficult question to me because I'm no specialist of Sun Yat-sen, but I mean, you know, I'm of this in this line. But still, the problem with Sun Yat-sen is that there were many contradictions in his views. And for instance, there was a clearly democratic apparatus in his plan for constitution, and then there was this notion of a period of a how do you say in English, tutelage? Tutelage. Meaning that exactly as in the discourse that I discussed, that the people are not mature enough for democracy. So during a certain period of time, it's necessary to have a tutelage by a government which is not elected and not democratically. So this is an example. As far as local autonomy is concerned, I wouldn't, maybe there are Sun Yat-sen specialists in this room, but I don't think he was very sanguine about it. He was rather a centralizer and you know, top-down sort of leader, but I wouldn't like to be too specific about it.
Sure.
Yes. Well, that's more or less what they are envisioning. I mean, the problem in Hong Kong is that, again, I'm no specialist of these things, but everybody knows about it more or less. When Hong Kong was handed over, the democratic institutions were very limited. I mean, you know, the number of elected parliamentary members, and how do they call it, LECO? I mean, the small, you know, parliament, etc. And there was a kind of a route, you know, that was traced, and the government in Beijing is resisting, you know, and trying to slow down, etc. At one time, these things change all the time. At one point, there were very important popular manifestations in Hong Kong. So the people claiming for more democracy seems to have really doing well. But more recently, it's very different. There is a kind of it seems to me there is a kind in Hong Kong of. Depression almost about this, and so I don't know. As for Taiwan, it's extremely different. It's not it's a thriving and really vibrant democracy with all sorts of problems, corruption and contentious. Even you know they love to fight even. So that's but still it's extremely lively. And when Taiwan is to be some sort of reunited to the mainland, which seems difficult to avoid, and one can only hope that it will be in a long time and without any violence, and I suppose that this system would be couldn't be curbed and changed. So there would be a multi-system, as you say. Now the thing is that, as far as I know, you have already a two system, one country, you know, with Hong Kong. But the two systems are very carefully isolated from one another. I mean, the frontier to Hong Kong between China and Hong Kong is supposed to be the same country. It's certainly one of the most difficult to cross, for a Chinese at least. So that there is a possibility, yes, of a political entity with different systems, a big system, which we don't know too much what it will is going to do to be in 10 or 20 years, and this very lively democracy in Taiwan. So, but I say predictions, not my thing.
On the aisle back there.
No, many people have said that, yeah. I wouldn't.
Yeah, could we hear the answer now, please?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't, it's too different. But it's true that the notion of the mandate of heaven and of the right to rebel, which is, you know, it's found in a half paragraph in Mencius, and that's it. So it's not. But still, it's true that it existed. But I don't think you can compare this, put this on the same level as the much more legal institutions that we are talking about when we talk of democracy. Now, the thing is that, to give you a concrete example, I've always been very, very impressed by the way during the Qing dynasty, which I happen to have studied a little, whenever the Qing was in the 18th century, the government was extremely well installed and certainly not threatened to be put out of power. Whenever there was a small rebellion, you know, by some crazy guys in some hilly country who said, "We are the great Ming," etc., the central government in of the Qing, they were panicked, it would seem. And they were extremely nervous because this proves the force of this notion of mandate of heaven, because there were really any manifestations, even folkloristic, as we would say, manifestation of anti-dynastic, using the words of the ideology of the mandate of heaven, was taken seriously. So in this way, but it's very far from any hint of democracy. It's not the same thing.
We'll take the last question here.
I heard that there were 5 million people in China who were withdrawing from the Chinese Communist Party at very great risk to themselves as a result of the publishing of the 9 commentaries on the Chinese Communist Party. I wonder if you had heard of that.
I saw it on the internet maybe yesterday, yeah. I saw it on the internet maybe yesterday, but I have no detail at all.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating.
So what is this 9?
It's a series of editorials by Da Juan, which is Epoch Times.
Yeah.
And it's sort of uncensored history of the Chinese, and it's sort of untwisting people's minds around the history of it, and it's causing this huge wave of resignation.
Yeah, I would like.
Totally upsetting be.
Yeah, I would like to see it, to believe it. But I saw. Now I remember where I saw that. Yeah, yeah.
Tony, we'll make one more.
Locally, yes. Locally, yeah, certainly. You mean tourism?
Tourism.
Yeah. No, it does. It does, but in many ways. I mean, for instance, there are things that you cannot, that you have to. I mean, things that to be clean and and well organized for tourists. That for sure. And many. It happens that I've done a little tourism in China this summer, and I was really struck by the industry of, souvenir, all these small stores that you have everywhere. It's horrible. I mean, it kills complete sites, but it's a local industry which makes certainly a living for many people. So, it's a resource. But if you mean if tourism has an impact on the political thinking, and no, I don't think so.
I'm now going to call on Dr. Tim Brook from Green College to express our thanks to the
speaker. St. John's College.
St. John's?
That's all right.
There's so many saints. Who can keep track of them?
The relationship between democratization in China is an endlessly interesting puzzle. And this evening, Pierre-Etienne Ville has given us a very optimistic interpretation of this. One of the things that most struck me about his comments was when, in a sense, he defined democracy, and he said, the avoidance of conflict is not conducive to the healthy practice of democracy, and pointed out that many Chinese state leaders and intellectuals have been rather pessimistic. Of course, they're not alone, because if any of you have children or grandchildren who are supposed to be at school the last 2 weeks in BC, you'll know that we have a very healthy practice of democracy here in British Columbia, and I have to say some parents are not happy about this. But as long as we don't avoid conflict, we can hope for some kind of creative resolution to the problem. Well, Professor Veal has suggested that the Chinese have exactly the same capacity for this as we do. They have the resources, and he seems to be mildly optimistic that they may be able to use them. Before I ask you to join me in thanking him, I am from St. John's College, and the talk tonight is one of several St. John's lectures that will be given during the year of the Vancouver Institute. I think we had four last year, and we'll have perhaps two or three this year. Professor Veal is here as a guest of St. John's College. He will be giving further lectures, if you are interested, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of the coming week. Monday and Tuesday at St. John's College at 5 o'clock. Wednesday at the Institute of Asian Research at 12:30. These lectures are open to the public, and you are welcome to attend. And if you don't get a chance to speak to him then to thank him, would you please give him your thanks now?